Welcome to Current State for Friday. I'm Mark Bayshore. At the top, we'll mention that Current State is prepared to go to NPR for any significant breaking developments in the Boston area. We will update the situation at half past the hour here, and that morning edition's coverage of this extraordinary story from Boston and the suburbs, if you'd prefer to stay with that, is, of course, available at AM 870 WKAR, our AM station, 870 WKAR. If you're listening online to us right now, just redirect your browser to our AM station, AM 870 WKAR. Teresa Szymanski joined the Lansing Police Department in 1987. She earned her stripes over the years and rose to become the city's police chief in 2010. Her tenure's been marked with successes and setbacks. Chief Szymanski helped institute Ingham County's new 911 dispatch center and led research-driven policing efforts to high-crime areas. But her department also had to weather severe budget cutbacks and layoffs. Tomorrow, Teresa Szymanski retires from the Lansing Police Department. She joins me now in the studio to talk about her time at the helm of Lansing law enforcement. Good morning, Chief Szymanski.
Good morning, Mark. How are you?
I'm fine. As a career law enforcement professional, I feel obligated to ask you what your thoughts are this morning regarding these extraordinary events in Boston and Watertown.
Oh, my goodness. How horrific is that? I can't imagine what that departments, agencies, the community, everyone is going through. They're in a lockdown. They've locked down their community. You know, they're sheltering in place. Their intensity must just, and their focus must be just over the top in terms of looking for the suspect.
And he appears to be holed up in a house at this point, presumably surrounded by law enforcement officers, and
sure,
their concerns that they'll be able to take this guy alive.
Absolutely, take them alive, and safety for not only him, but for the police officers, the law enforcement officers, and the entire community, because certainly everyone wants to come out of this with their safety.
Yeah. I have to follow a question like that with your most extraordinary incident in your long career here in Lansing. Hopefully it doesn't compare to the stress and the challenge of that, but...
Well, absolutely. We've had some situations here in my 26 years in Lansing, and even when I was a police officer in Douglas, Wyoming, where we've had officer-involved shootings, we've had barricaded situations, hostage situations. Those are very, very intense situations. And the men and women who are on the front line negotiating or involved in those, it's intense, and we do have them. Fortunately, we haven't had nothing to the magnitude that Boston has had, but we have isolated incidents from time to time.
Can you comment at all on how the training of a police officer is different in 2013? Here in the post-9/11 period in general, to think this morning that there was not just a shootout with these two suspects early,
sure,
this morning in Watertown, Massachusetts, they were contending not only with handgun fire, but with some number of pressure cooker bombs at the same time.
Yeah.
It's really extraordinary.
That is extraordinary. And that's why the training that we take, we our officers get a lot of training, and we're very fortunate to be able to do that, but it's also needed very much. And you must take it seriously. You must pay attention and be engaged in the training, because things have changed. I mean, 29 years ago, who would have thought something like this would have happened? But our officers are trained very well. They're trained intensely. Our tactical team is, I would take them against anybody in the state. They're the best and the brightest. But again, training is significantly important.
Well, given the technological changes, too, it must require updating and ongoing training like never before.
Never before. They train on a monthly basis, and it's very intense, and they're very committed to what they do.
Let's talk a little bit about your successor before we talk more about the past here. Former Captain Mike Yankowski was named interim chief by Mayor Virge Brunero yesterday at a ceremony at Sexton High School here in Lansing. Here's what the city's new interim police chief had to say.
Words like excellence, character, respect, teamwork, compassion, and courage will define the Lansing Police Department. We will continue to work closely with our neighborhoods, businesses, and schools to build those strong partnerships to keep this city safe. We will also work closely with our schools to strengthen our safety for our young individuals. Our youth is the future in this community, and it's our job to make sure that they go down the right path, and anything we can do as a police department community is our responsibility.
Teresa Szymanski, tell us a little bit more about Captain Jankowski, please.
He is stellar, Mark. He is a fantastic police officer, a wonderful human being, and the city of Lansing is just so blessed to have him. He's very committed. He's dedicated. He has a lot of experience. He was a patrol officer. He's risen through the ranks. He's worked internal affairs, a canine. He was a supervisor for the canine unit. But what's great about Mike is that he is involved with the community. He understands the partnerships. He gets it. And he understands the need to be proactive in working with the community to solve crime issues. And he's also very progressive. You know, we just talked about training. There's a guy who lives and breathes training. And he's about looking at future trends and not living in the past. He's moving forward all the time. He just does a fantastic job.
Should we be prepared for him to become the full-time chief then?
I certainly think that he would make a fantastic full-time chief, and if he's interested and goes through the process, he'll certainly be a great candidate for that position.
It looks like one of your last major duties as chief was stepping up security at this Sunday's Lansing Marathon. Can you briefly update us on how that's changed?
We've added additional officers to participate in Sunday's Marathon. We're working closely with our law enforcement partners, both state and federal, in addition to providing some extra security sweeps using our bomb dogs and other bomb dogs from the Tri-County area.
So more personnel.
Absolutely.
And more security sweeps with bomb dogs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's correct.
And I understand flooding has also altered the route of the course here this morning. Are you up to speed on that?
I am a little bit, yes. They've changed the route due to the flooding along the Lansing River Trail, so they're going to a Plan B. But I know that the committee is working hard together, and it's going to be a successful marathon, and we're excited to have everyone coming into the city of Lansing to participate in this second annual marathon.
We'll point out that Owen Anderson, the race director, is also scheduled to join us here before the end of the hour to update that situation as well. What kind of condition generally is the Lansing Police Department in as you're leaving it versus when you first became chief 3 years ago?
Well, certainly the biggest challenge that I've had in the last 3 years is the economics. You know, we've had to fight. I was the first and only chief that I know of to ever have to lay off police officers. And by far, that was the hardest thing that I ever had to do. I'm pleased to report that all the laid off officers that wanted to return back to the city of Lansing have returned. And I feel very confident, Mark, that we've turned the corner on the budget. It's still tough times ahead, but I'm optimistic. And I like to believe that we're moving forward in the right direction. We've got great leadership, not only under Captain, now Interim Chief Mike Jankowski, but additional captains and lieutenants on that department are young, they're bright, they're creative, and they're very bold, and they'll do a fantastic job. In terms of our officers, they continue to go out and work hard every day, and I'm pleased. I couldn't be happier for the Lansing Police Department.
In pretty short order, 2 years ago, the South Precinct closed. There was a reduction in your motorcycle unit, a reduction in neighborhood watch, and a reduction in your undercover unit. Can you go a little bit deeper for us as to how you've managed to navigate all of those reductions?
Yeah, well, it hasn't been easy by any stretch of the imagination, but it came to teamwork. It came to everybody in the department joining hands and hanging on and working together. You know, we've asked a lot of our officers to do more with less, and they've stepped up. Our Neighborhood Watch program has almost 180 participants in it. We started a Business Watch program, and we do that now with one officer, where before we used to have, back in the day, seven or eight. A couple years ago, we had two, and now we're down to one. But she does that with a good support from the community, too. They understand that, and they're engaged. We've got a great Neighborhood Watch advisory board. Our undercover unit has certainly decreased. But still, it's our partnerships with law enforcement, the federal government, ATF, DEA. They've jumped on board. They help us out. So it's really more about building partnerships, whether it's with the community or other law enforcement agencies that help us kind of keep the ship running down the right direction here.
Some of those partnerships were definitely in play back in January when you were here on the show 3 months ago. We talked about 19 people who had just been arrested on gun charges, and that was done with assistance from ATF in January. Where does that case stand right now? Have charges been dropped? Have charges been pursued? What?
That was a significant case, and thank you for bringing that up. We're moving forward with prosecution on that case, both state and federal prosecution. As you just mentioned, Mark, 19 people were indicted either on state or federal charges, and they're in the court system. No charges have been dropped. We're moving full bore ahead with prosecution on those cases.
Also on your last visit here in mid-January, the gun law reform debate was raging. We talked about your support of the call by the group Mayors Against Illegal Guns for requiring criminal background checks on all gun sales, a ban on military-style assault weapons and high-capacity magazines, and for making gun trafficking a federal crime. Legislatively, since January, expectations have been dialed way down. On Wednesday of this week, the Senate dropped the issue for the time being when there were not enough votes for what many people considered a very tame background checks measure. As a law enforcement professional, what do you make of these attempts to reform gun laws, and what do you make of the opposition to them?
It's extremely frustrating. I think those, and I still believe that the reform needs to happen. It still needs to be a priority. And when it doesn't happen, to me, it's frustrating that the politics of the situation, I understand, but it's certainly frustrating for law enforcement.
What are your plans?
Well, I have offered a couple jobs in the private sector, and I'm weighing my options right now, but I'm in no hurry. You know, I've been doing this 29 years, Mark, and I'm looking forward to a few days off and maybe picking up the golf clubs and working on my golf game a little bit.
What are you going to miss most about LPD?
I'm going to miss the people by far. We've got fantastic people there, and I'm going to miss the community. I'm very much engaged in the Lansing community, and I'm going to continue to stay on some boards and continue some of my commitments there, but I'm definitely going to miss the people.
What are you not going to miss?
Oh, my goodness. What am I not going to miss? Certainly the, you know, there's always some struggles, and I won't miss those, but we'll see. It's been a good ride, and I've enjoyed myself very much.
Teresa Szymanski has been with the Lansing Police Department since 1987. She's been the city's police chief since 2010. Today is her last official day on the job, and we appreciate your joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
Good
Have a great
luck.
Day. Thank you.
Current State on WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Thanks very much for joining us. Once again, we are prepared to go to NPR for any significant breaking developments regarding the extraordinary events in the Boston area, and we will update the situation regardless here at half past the hour. Tom Paxton recently said that he enjoys songwriting more than ever, and he's been at it since the 60s. He was at the center of America's folk revival then, performing in Greenwich Village with the likes of Bob Dylan and others. His decades-long career encompasses over 40 studio albums, a string of children's albums, a Grammy Lifetime Achievement Award, various causes, and it rolls on in 2013 with about 40 or 50 live performances booked for 2013. The next one is tonight in East Lansing at the 10 Pound Fiddle Coffee House. Tom Paxton, welcome to Current State.
Thanks, and it'll be great to be back in East Lansing.
That's right. You've been here a few times, right?
I have, yeah. I like it a lot there.
You recently said that you're having more fun writing songs now than you did earlier in your career, and I can understand how it might be as much fun as it was then, but how can it be more fun now after doing it all these years?
It's serious fun, for sure. It's perilously close to work. it's more fun for me because the more I learn about the process, everything becomes the process I love. I love the idea of looking for an idea and then of trying to develop it and going down false roads and maybe have a chorus that I like and can't find any verses that suit it, but gradually find them too. I'm much more patient now.
Okay.
Than I was. It used to be, you know, if you didn't write the song in 20 minutes, to hell with it. But now I have songs that I'll be doing tonight that actually took me a year or so between the beginning and completion. Just songs that I kept coming back to because almost in every case, I liked the chorus a lot. I liked singing the chorus, so I didn't want to give up on the song, and I kept coming back. And several songs now, it's taken me a long time to do, but I'm happy when I get them done.
It sounds like a fascinating process. You played the Gaslight in New York City when folk was really taking off in the early and mid-60s. What was it like to be at the center, or so close to the center, of that musical movement?
Well, it was exciting, and it was fun, and what no one really knows is that it was also a very insecure feeling. I mean, nobody knew if he or she would be able to keep doing this more than a couple years, you know. And I mean, I was in it for the long haul. I wanted to do nothing else but that, and yet I never knew if I was going to get enough work. Until, you know, several years went by before I began to see, well, okay, I can certainly do this for a while longer.
Yeah. What's it like going back there now?
It's interesting. I was actually back in the Gaslight a few months ago. It's reopened as 116 McDougal, and it's completely different inside than it was. So there was very little nostalgia attached to the experience. But it's wonderful to go back to the village and walk around, and the memories just come, you know, leaping out of every corner. And I remember, you know, old friends. I remember, Fred Neal and Tim Harden and Phil Oakes. So many old friends who are no longer with us, and I can remember where we were and the kettle of fish, the table that we all had there that was a kind of a permanent party that people would go and do their sets and come back and resume the seat at the table, and sitting at that table in the kettle of fish, which was right next door to the Gaslight, by the way. One night I was sitting next to Bob, and there was some argument going on with the other guys, and Bob said, Tom, what do you think of this? And he leaned over, and he sang in my ear Gates of Eden that he had just written.
Oh, my.
And I thought, you know, I said, Bob, that is a fantastic song. That is gorgeous. Another night I came in. We had this room upstairs in the tenement building that we stored guitar cases and stuff in, and we had a kind of a permanent poker game going in there. And I came in one night, and Bob was just finished typing this long poem. And he said, what do you think of this? And I read it, and I said, what are you going to do with it? He said, well, I don't know. What do you think I should do? And I said, well, you should put a tune to it, because you know, it's a great poem, but if you send it off to some, literary magazine, they'll give you $25 and that'll be it. So the next night he came in the Gaslight. He would sing late at night at the Gaslight. He was never on the bill, but he was always there.
Okay.
And he got up and sang this song, It's a Hard Rain's Gonna Fall.
Oh, my.
And I laughingly say now that, you know, when I hear it now and it gets into like the sixth or seventh minute, I think, what was I thinking? What? But it's a brilliant song.
Hard Rain.
It's a 20th century hip take on the Lord Randall old English ballad.
Okay. What song of your own are you proudest for having written?
Well, that's hard to say. It's hard to say. I guess if you back me against the wall, I'd say The Last Thing on My Mind.
Last Thing on My Mind. Okay, yeah. Certainly been recorded by so many people over the years, and one that everybody's familiar with. Is there a song or two you really wish you had written, as opposed to somebody else had written?
I would have to say Turn, Turn, Turn. I think that's a magnificent song. I love the credit on the song, Ecclesiastes Seeger.
That's right.
Let's
listen to another one of your best-known songs. This is our special guest this morning, folk singer-songwriter Tom Paxton, and a little bit of Ramblin' Boy.
And here's to you, my ramblin' boy. May all your ramblin' bring you joy. Here's to you, my ramblin' boy. May all your ramblin' bring you joy. In Tulsa Town.
Such a nice melodic track, Tom.
Thank you.
Is it still special performing it?
It is, yeah. I like to tell people about when I got up the courage to sing it for Pete. And a couple weeks later, he sang it in Carnegie Hall with the Weavers on a recording. I didn't know what to think. I was so excited about that.
You're off to London and Manchester and Scotland in a few days for some dates. What's the best part about performing live in 2013 as opposed to some point in the past?
The people, the response from the audience, the back and forth, that's what it's always been, you know, just a sharing experience. I find that the audiences in the UK are just like the audiences in East Lansing. I suppose perhaps there'll be a few more younger people in East Lansing tonight than my usual graying crowd, but... it's the people that keep me coming, you know. I hate the travel. I'm going to hang up the phone here in a minute and leave for the airport. And I don't enjoy the travel at all. But it's all worth it when I can sing to people and have them sing with me.
Well, Tom Paxton performs tonight here in East Lansing at the 10 Pound Fiddle Coffee House. It's been great talking with you. Enjoy your visit back to town and continued success.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. We have continuing coverage of the latest out of Boston on AM 870 WKAR. Keep that in mind. We'll be back with more of Current State after NPR News. I'm Mark Bayshore.
With a dark and rolling sea between my true love and me, I keep walking through this cold, hard town. While I wait for better days, I could use a place to stay, or a floor where I could lay my blanket down. If I could beg, steal...
Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Keep in mind that Morning Edition's coverage of the Boston Watertown developments, if you'd prefer to stay with that, is available on AM 870 WKAR. It's Friday. The Michigan Seal reads, "If you seek a pleasant peninsula, look about you." Well, it's in Latin, so it doesn't say that exactly. But travelers from outside the state are figuring out what Michiganders have known for years. Michigan is a destination. Last year, the state saw an increase in tourism spending, most of which can be attributed to travelers from other states. This week at the annual Pure Michigan Governors Conference on Tourism, MSU professor and tourism expert Sarah Nichols predicted another year of industry growth. Nichols joins current state's Emmanuel Berry to unveil why Michigan's tourism industry is growing.
What we saw last year was a 6% increase in tourism spending, and the measure that we use for spending is how much money is collected by the state as far as collections from hotels and motels. So that's the 6% spending figure that we use. We also saw, however, increases at a lot of our attractions around the state. So as one, a record example, the Henry Ford in Dearborn saw a 25% increase in visitation last year. They had 1.9 million visitors. A lot of that was to do with the Titanic exhibition, which is obviously a temporary exhibition. But they also have a new Driving in America exhibition. So that was a big year. Our national parks also did phenomenally well. The Sleeping Bear Dunes saw a 15% increase in visitation. We think a lot of that has to do with the previous voting of Sleeping Bear Dunes as the most beautiful place in America.
Which it is.
which I will agree it is. But also Pictured Rocks and Isle Royale saw 6 and 5% increases in visitation. And just to give you context, the increase across the United States as a whole, so at all 400 sites, was just 1%.
So what are, you said there was an increase this past year in 2012. What are the projections for how it's all going to turn out next year in regards to spending on tourism in the state?
So what we're projecting is another good, solid year for travel in Michigan. So we think that we'll see about a 3% increase in volume and a 5 to 6% increase in spending, which would be sort of a similar percentage increase as last year. So a couple of unknowns or unpredictables are always, of course, the weather. Mm-hmm. And last year we had a lovely hot, dry summer, which was great for our summer tourism. And we can't control that. Gas prices are always an issue, and gas prices actually were relatively stable last year. They only, in inverted commas, went up 4% last year. And just for context, the year before, they went up 26%. So if gas prices can stay in the range that they've been in recently, sort of the 350 to 390, we think that at this point, that's an acceptable amount for the average traveler to pay at the pump. The other issue that we don't know quite how will impact travel would, of course, be the sequester and the extent to which that will impact the delivery of services, for example, at our national parks, if there are cutbacks in maintenance and services, and also at our border crossings. If there are fewer immigration officers available and that increases the wait time, obviously that doesn't make travelers typically very happy to have to wait longer to come across a bridge or through a tunnel or through an airport to get into the state. But overall, the industry hit a tough spot back in 08, 09. It's recovered really strongly for several years in a row now. And with continued Pure Michigan, we really think that the industry is really on a very positive trajectory.
Why Michigan? What is it about Michigan that's bringing people here and making them more willing to spend their money, say, than, 4 or 5 years ago? What is it about this state right now?
I think the vast majority of this is all to do with the Pure Michigan campaign. So this was a campaign that was initiated in 2006, and it went national in 2009. So that was the first year that Michigan was advertised nationally as a tourism destination. And visitation has increased every year since then. Typically we find that people outside of Michigan don't have much of an image of Michigan at all, or it tends to be somewhat tainted by the perception or misperception, depending on how you see it, of Detroit. Mm-hmm. What the Pure Michigan campaign is doing is making more people aware of the state, and in particular the phenomenal resources, and obviously the Great Lakes coastline is one of those, but more aware, but also more willing to give Michigan a chance as a destination.
So are these people who are coming, are they coming from all over the state? Is it in-state tourism that's accounting for this somewhat? Where are these people coming from that are creating this increase?
The majority of travelers within Michigan are still people coming from within Michigan, but that's a pretty flat number. The increases are in people coming from outside of the state. And in particular, we're seeing more people from the southern states as well as the East Coast. So there was a news article recently talking about people coming in from the New York and sort of Traverse City area becoming the New Hamptons. We're also seeing more people coming from the southern states, you know, Texas and Georgia, where in the summer it's incredibly hot and humid and not very nice to be outside. I lived in Texas for 5 years. So for people there to come to Michigan and have an 85-degree day is the perfect day. And so obviously, especially for our outdoor activities, hiking and biking and boating and fishing and, of course, golfing, 85 degrees is a perfect day to be outside, and we have a fabulous resource, natural resource base to spend that time outside.
So for once, Michigan weather is not bringing us down.
No, for summer, and especially, you know, if you believe in climate change, our climate will only become even more attractive as the southern states become even more hot and more humid than they already are.
Now, your report also mentioned some of the trends that are drawing people in general in tourism, but some things that in particular that Michigan has. So one of them is food and beverages. How is Michigan attracting the foodies?
Based around our foods and our beverages is a really rapidly growing niche right now. So more and more people are interested in food in general. They're more interested in where their food came from and learning more about where their food came from. And they're keener to eat local foods and drink local drinks. And obviously with the second most agriculturally diverse state in the country after California, so we have a phenomenal selection of fruits and vegetables and other foodstuffs. We also have really growing and fantastic wine and beer industries in this state. And I think those are two of the really hot areas that we're seeing, not just local and regional recognition, but national recognition as wine and beer destinations. So as one example, Traverse City was named one of the three emerging beer towns for 2012 by Draft Magazine last year. And so, Grand Rapids was tied for Beer City USA last year.
Now, you're also the leader of the 2012 through 2017 Michigan Tourism Strategic Plan. Where do you see Michigan's tourism industry going in the next 4 years? What's the future of tourism in Michigan?
Well, we spent the last year developing this second five-year strategic plan. And the vision is for Michigan to become one of America's favorite Four Seasons travel experiences. So there again, the emphasis on the Four Season experience. And within that plan, we have 8 goals. And underneath each of the goals, between 2 and 6 different objectives. So we have lots of objectives that we've set for ourselves. One of the goals relates to promotion and marketing and communication. So expanding the reach of the Pure Michigan campaign.
So global, essentially?
Well, so currently, the last couple of years, we've received, the industry has received about $25 million to market itself. The governor has proposed an additional $4 million for the next fiscal year. And if that's received, it would be used primarily in the international market. And there are sort of 3 key areas. One would be Toronto. So we currently market in Ontario, but we don't market in Toronto. And that's obviously a big and wealthy market. Mm-hmm. The second area would be more marketing in the UK, which is probably where you can tell where I'm from, but also the German-speaking countries. And then the third, and what would be a new area for us, would be Asia, and in particular South Korea and Japan, and of course China, which is the booming tourism market as far as outbound international travelers.
There's a lot of international students here at MSU, and they're always the thing they talk about is how beautiful it is here and how, you know, the lakes, and that they have this opportunity to experience a very different environment from maybe what they grew up in with Asia. So I can see that potentially being a big draw for the state.
And absolutely. And the international students that we have here is actually a market that we've talked about during the plan, in that, you know, we have more and more international students, and obviously they all have friends and relatives back home. And one of the things we've talked about is some kind of an ambassador program where we can really more actively encourage these students to encourage all of their friends and relatives to come visit them and explore the state and obviously have a fantastic experience and go back home and tell more and more people how worthwhile it is to come to Michigan and spend some time here and enjoying our beautiful state.
Sarah Nichols is an MSU professor and tourism expert. She's also the leader of the Michigan Tourism Strategic Plan. The trumpet shall sound Saturday night at 8 p.m. at Hill Auditorium in Ann Arbor. World-renowned trumpeter Allison Balsam will take the stage in Ann Arbor with the Scottish Ensemble for an evening of Baroque music for trumpet and orchestra. WKAR's Peter Worf previews the performance with Balsam. Allison says she's looking forward to her first visit to Hill Auditorium and experiencing its legendary acoustics.
Yeah, it makes such a huge difference to me because obviously with the trumpet, it's like a voice, you know, that it just the sound just blossoms. And, you know, with a good acoustic, you don't have to put so much physical energy into it, which means you've got more room to just kind of express yourself and just sort of act very naturally.
In a number of the videos I've watched of you, we see you in glorious acoustical spaces in churches and the like.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they work the best for the trumpet, really. You know, the music and also the style of the music, often it was written for those buildings. And that's what really adds that kind of magical kind of a special occasion, I suppose, to the sound.
I've heard you speak in other interviews about a lot of the music you play, particularly the program that you'll be bringing on this tour into Ann Arbor as flamboyant, joyous, and extroverted. And we're talking about now a time of cultural, social, political, and architectural flamboyance, and it fits so well with the program that you'll be playing.
Yeah, I mean, my first priority with this program really was just to kind of take the audience and the listener on a journey, you know, because I think there's a bit of a preconceived ideas of what you're going to get at a trumpet concert. And some people are a bit nervous about a trumpet concert because they think it's going to be just one thing, very loud, very powerful. But really, the thing I love about the trumpet is that it's so flexible and so able to be like a voice, that I've really tried to program it so it's very varied and it's very interesting, it's very contrasting. So we really do go to many different styles and genres, really, within classical music, you know, and within, you know, some of the slow movements are very much about the long lines and the kind of oboe sound, and some of the outer movements are about, you know, the flashiness of the violin, and some of them are very trumpety, and it's just a case of taking people on an interesting journey, really.
You alluded to violin. You'll be performing some pieces that have been arranged from the original violin work to the trumpet.
That's right. In particular, one of my favorites is by Antonio Vivaldi. Now, this piece has been through many guises. It actually was stolen by Bach, which, you know, he had enough of his own music, so it's not... And he kind of gave it a new life. So I felt if Bach could arrange it, then I could rearrange it for the trumpet. And so this is... a concerto originally for the violin, went to the organ, and then I started playing it with trumpet and organ, and then I thought, I know, let's go back to the original with the strings, but I'll take the violin part. And this concerto in D major is very bright and sprightly and very happy. And And the second movement is really lyrical and reflective. And the last movement is really very technically demanding, but joyous and very kind of live, you know. And I think what's really important, this music was written so long ago, it's just about how to make it feel present and, you know, like it matters now. And I think this is, even though it's a very short piece, sort of 8 minutes or something, it really covers all those things. And that's why I enjoy playing it so much.
You also mentioned this notion of composers rearranging their own music, stealing from others, but also even borrowing from themselves. Common practice in the time that we're talking about here.
It really was. And what's interesting, it was all the real great masters. You know, they had ideas coming out of their ears. They really had so many ideas. It's not like they needed to, as you say, you know, pinch someone else's idea. It was more, I think, a sort of a respect, you know, a mark of respect for the other's work. So it was very sort of, it was almost like a camaraderie between these great, great masters. We're talking Vivaldi and Bach and Albinoni and all these people who, they really knew what they were doing. And it was a time when there was a lot of experimentation, you know, within this very sort of what seems like a real rigid structure. There was a lot of freedom of expression and the sense of, you know, maybe improvising this ornament here or changing this little bit here. And I think it's important for us nowadays, you know, although we have great respect for every note and every nuance of every note because we want to just recreate it really faithfully. We have to remember that we have to bring this stuff to life. We can't just play the notes. We have to add our own modern take on them, you know. So that's what we'll try to do. And I think that's why it's really important to play classical music with as much energy and life as we possibly can.
Trumpeter Alison Balsam performs at Hill Auditorium on the University Musical Society's April 20th date. Alison, thanks so much.
Pleasure. Looking forward to visiting you all.
For Current State, this is Peter Whorf.
Current State here on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore, and on that energetic note, a reminder that runners from around Michigan, the Midwest, as well as from Europe and South America, all gather Sunday for the second annual Lansing Marathon. At last year's inaugural event, about 1,700 runners participated in either the marathon itself, the half marathon, or any of three other events. The race contributes some of its proceeds to various charitable and service organizations, and here to talk about how the second year's event is shaping up, about economic impact, about security and other aspects of the event, race director Owen Anderson. Nice to see you.
Thank you very much, Mark. Great to be with you this morning.
Out of the chute, we should talk about how flooding apparently has altered the course. We got into this with Lansing Police Chief Teresa Szymanski not too long ago. What's happening from your perspective here?
Well, you know, when we planned the course a couple of months ago, we wanted to make it a very beautiful course for running. And we looked at the river trail and thought that it would be perfect for the marathon and half marathon courses. So we ended up with about 7 miles of river trail running or walking within the event. And that was, of course, during our drought. We didn't expect monsoon-like conditions to occur during the past week or so. That's changed everything. And a lot of the river trail is flooded right now, of course.
So how much of the course is different? A mile, a mile and a half mile, what?
Well, we did have about 7 miles of river trail, as I mentioned, and about five of those are gone now because of the flooding.
Five.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we've added 5 miles of street running instead. The good news is that the street running is very, very good. It's very pleasant. It's through good neighborhoods and on very pleasant streets to run on.
Is it a different course from last year, or is it the same as last year? It's different.
Yeah. It is different. Okay. It has some similar elements. I mean, we have a different start. Last year we started on Grand. This year we started on Michigan Avenue, right in front of the Lansing Center, so close to that. And we go down Michigan just as we did last year. But you'll recall that last year we headed way south. We went down into the MSU Farm area. We went over into Meridian Township, even down into Ingham County, we could say. So we had kind of a Siberian section to the course, which was very cold and windy last year.
Yes, it was.
So we tightened things up, and actually this is an all-Lansing course this year. Everything's within the boundaries of Lansing. Huh. But we're very excited about it. Even with the modifications we've had to make because of the flooding, we still have a very varied course. Urban elements, nice residential neighborhoods, still retained a couple of miles of river trail that won't be flooded on Sunday.
You had to make some really serious logistical changes here. It sounds like do you have a number of 26-mile courses or templates, to put it in kind of computer terms, that you're prepared to go to in an event like this? That's just part of what goes into your planning?
It really does, because okay. You have to be prepared, especially since we had relied on the river trail thinking it would be okay for running. So in the backs of our minds, we were thinking, well, we'd better have some alternatives. So Bill Ewing, our operations director, and Andy Marsh, our course director, have done a fabulous job of just being ready to change the course. And it's nice, too, to work with Lansing City officials. They've been so flexible, so helpful. Police, fire, public service, traffic engineering, they want this event to be successful. So they've been adjusting, too.
How many total runners are signed up to run in one event or another on Sunday?
Total, if we add the marathon, half marathon, relay, 5K, and kids race, we're at about 2,200 right now.
Okay,
I
so
expect
you're
more.
Ahead of last year, then.
Yes, and we expect even more. People are really signing up now.
How late can people get involved?
Very important. Online registration ends tonight at midnight. But people can come to our expo tomorrow at the Lansing Center from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. and register there for any of the events except the 5K, which occurs tomorrow morning at 9:30, and the kids' race, which is tomorrow morning at 11. But they can still register for the marathon, half marathon, and relay tomorrow at the expo. And again, they can run it or walk it. And there will be some pre-race registration Sunday morning beginning at 6.
Oh.
Remember that race time is at 8 o'clock Sunday morning, but if people come in at 6, between 6 and 7:30, they can register then.
Teresa Szymanski and I got into the added security of the event since Monday's events in Boston. Has that changed the logistics of the event in any way? Has it impacted the course of the race at all?
No, not really, because okay. Lansing Police operate so effectively. They're so flexible. Of course, a key area of concern is the start and finish line, and that was going to be present no matter whether we change the course or not. So there'd be very, very heightened security, not only there, but all around the course as well.
How much money total, your gross, not your net, but your gross, do you take in, and where does it all go?
Well, we take in over $250,000 total from registrations and sponsorships, and it really goes to operate the race. To pay for our paid staff, to pay for policing, to pay for timing and scoring of the race, and for advertising, all the different things that are involved in the marathon, for shirts, signs, you know, all the expenses.
You pay yourself a little bit, though, don't you?
A tiny bit.
Or no,
yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In a pragmatic sense, Owen, what's the key to growing this event?
That's a great question. I think it's really a couple of things that we can do better. One, I think the timing of our marketing efforts is very important. We need to get our marketing promotions out there toward the end of December, beginning of January, when people make their decisions. And also, we want to get more sponsorship dollars coming in and make it an elite race as well. Because if we have elite runners coming in, that creates more interest in the race.
Right.
That's what, you know, races in communities the size of Lansing have done. We don't have a big audience as New York and Chicago do, but we can make it a, you know, first-class event and attract the elite runners to come in, and people will register in increased numbers.
The Lansing Marathon is back. 5 different events this Sunday in the city of Lansing. We've been talking with race director Owen Anderson. Owen, good luck. Hope Sunday goes well.
Thanks so much, Mark. I appreciate that.
Coming up on Current State this weekend, are jeans patentable? Patentable. That's the question the U.S. Supreme Court is pondering. We'll have a segment. Emmanuel Berry unveils more details about how that ruling could impact research universities like MSU. Continuing coverage of the Boston episode is on AM 870 WKAR. Keep that in mind. I'm Mark Bayshore. You've been listening to Current State on WKAR.
Support for WKAR is provided by MSU Federal Credit Union, providing credit union members with 24-hour account access online and now on your mobile internet, insured by NCUA. And by the Lansing State Journal, offering up-to-date news and information 24 hours a day, 7 days a week on your phone, tablet, and online at lsj.com.